Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, hard to believe we're watching the summer wind down rather quickly, it seems, which means we're gearing up for the changes that autumn brings. And it's also a time when families need to be hyper alert to immunization regulations for their school-aged children heading back to the classroom.
Kind of a seasonal ritual. As the summer winds down and school begins, families often find themselves caught unaware of the important immunizations that are required for their children as they return to school. The issue has become more pronounced of late as more families have actually opted out of immunizations for personal reasons.
A number of state health departments have become much more vigilant on the matter as we've seen a serious uptick of diseases like measles and pertussis, all vaccine preventable, but highly contagious and potentially deadly in young children especially.
Well, you know, Mark, I'm not sure everybody realizes this, but immunizations might just be one of the singular public health achievements of 20th century healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone has any questions about vaccine protocols, we would encourage them to check out this terrific resource from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's cdc.gov/features/catch-up-immunizations. There's a lot of great information at that site, as there is on the entire CDC website. And the long-term empirical data are pretty clear, Mark. Vaccinations save lives.
They certainly do, Margaret. Roughly one-third of the nation's children are covered by Medicaid in this country, which brings us to our guest today. Matt Salo is the executive director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors.
Well, the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act led to millions of Americans gaining coverage, but there is a lot of uncertainty over what might happen next to this program that covers some 76 million Americans. Matt Salo is one of the nation's leading experts on the subject. Mark, so really looking forward to this conversation.
Laurie Robertson also checks in with us. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love to hear from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Matt Salo in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. HHS Secretary Tom Price has traveled to Southeast Asia to meet with leading health officials from the region. The trip aimed at shoring up the world's readiness to combat disease outbreaks and how best to support global health security. He met with officials from Japan, China, and Vietnam. Roughly 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with invasive breast cancer in this country, and now there's more fodder for confusion on the mammogram front. Recently, the recommendations for annual mammograms after age 40 had been relaxed somewhat, suggesting instead that after a baseline mammogram, regular screenings should commence after age 45, and even less frequently, depending upon what both patient and clinician decide. Now, a study out of Cornell Weill Medical Center suggests regular annual screenings between age 40 and 80 would eliminate almost 40% of invasive breast cancer deaths. While American Cancer Society President Dr. Otis Brawley admits those earlier screenings catch more cancers, the likelihood of false positives are much higher at those younger ages. The risk-benefit ratio begins to change around age 47 or 48, and the benefits of screening outweigh the risks of overdiagnosis. The researcher conducting the study found yearly mammograms starting at age 40 reduced breast cancer deaths by 40% compared to 23% reduction with the least stringent recommendations. World Hepatitis C Day has come and gone, a growing health threat in this country. 3.5 million Americans currently have the disease, which affects the liver and is caused by a virus spread through blood-to-blood contact. Many of those with Hep C do not know they have it, and the number of infections is rising along with the opioid crisis, with so many users sharing needles. There is a cure, but the cost is high, about $80,000 per patient for a 3-month course of daily pills. State public health officials are having a hard time securing the funds to treat more than a fraction of those who've been diagnosed. And Modern Healthcare is out with his list of most influential people in healthcare. And there's a new name in the number one spot. Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine, now holds that position. Collins was instrumental in forming a coalition to block the Senate bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Rounding out the top five, Senator John McCain, who gave that decisive thumbs down to the bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, another Republican who voted against. Kaiser Permanente CEO Bernard Tyson is at number four. Paul Ryan, President Trump, Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini, American Hospital Association President Rick Pollack, and R. Milton Johnson of HCA Healthcare round out the top 10. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Matt Salo, Executive Director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors, which represents all 56 of the nation's states and territorial Medicaid directors. Mr. Salo previously served for 12 years at the National Governors Association, where he worked on the governor's health care and human service reform agenda. Prior to that, he was a health policy analyst for state Medicaid directors as part of the American Public Human Service Association. He earned his BA in Eastern Religious Studies at the University of Virginia. Matt, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
May we live in interesting times, and you certainly have lived in interesting times in terms of Medicaid and all of the reforms that have happened. Going back to the Affordable Care Act, we've seen just such dramatic changes in this 60-year-old program. And if the current leadership in the White House and Congress have their way, I think we'll see more changes around the corner. And I think it's fair to say that I haven't really run into a healthcare person who actually can keep them right between Medicare and Medicaid. It really seems to be a problem. And you've been working on this issue, Medicaid, for two decades now. I'm wondering if you could lay out for our listeners the scope of the Medicaid program, who it covers, and what makes it so complicated to understand.
Sure. The way I like to describe it is that I use the bumper sticker test, which is if you can describe your mission or your point succinctly in a bumper sticker, you're halfway there towards winning any kind of argument. You know, what's the bumper sticker for what Medicare does? It's health care for old people.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty simple. People understand that. But when you try to do that for Medicaid, you really run into a problem. And the closest most people will get is health care for poor people. And that's not fully true.
Mm-hmm.
So what does Medicaid actually do? It does provide health care for some poor people. It provides health care for a lot of people who aren't poor. And there are a lot of things that Medicaid does that isn't actually health care in the traditional sense. You know, if you look at any given state, say Connecticut, Medicaid covers a very large number of pregnant women and kids.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Medicaid across the country covers about half the births. But when you think about, say, the parents, in a lot of states, say Alabama, if you are the parents and you're making one-fifth of the federal poverty level, you are too rich to qualify for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And prior to the ACA, if you were a single adult or a married couple with no kids, it didn't matter what your income was. You didn't qualify for Medicaid. So there's this whole patchwork. And then you sort of get into the huge role that Medicaid actually plays for people with physical, intellectual, mm-hmm. developmental disabilities, and the fact that Medicaid is the de facto long-term care program.
Right, right. Yeah.
So it's this amazingly broad scope of who we cover. And the second challenge is, once you think you've figured out how it works, you look across at your neighboring state and you realize they're doing it completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very, very hard program to easily digest and to talk about.
But, you know, when we look back to the dawn of the Affordable Care Act, one of the pillars was this expansion of Medicaid, which was intended to be across the country to all Americans living up to 138% of the poverty line. And then the Roberts Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, but refused to require states to adopt the mandatory Medicaid expansion. And that created a coverage divide, if you will, in this country. Can you talk a little bit about the coverage gains that we saw under the Medicaid program since the passage of the Affordable Care Act and how that changed healthcare and who's really been left out of that equation?
You know, for years we've been having this debate around, well, is this individual mandate unconstitutional and all this other stuff? And then, as you said, the Roberts Court comes out and says, oh, no, the whole thing's fine. The only problem with the Affordable Care Act is this Medicaid expansion. And they essentially turned it into an option. And as of right now, there are about 30 states that have done the option, and the rest have not. And in the states that have done it, all of those weird kind of silos or coverage gaps of, you know, parents above 20% of the poverty level or childless adults, in those states, they now have coverage for the first time. And in the states that haven't done the expansion, it's pretty much status quo. You know, in many cases, they are working, sometimes working multiple jobs.
Right.
But they're working in jobs that don't provide coverage, or they're just not making enough to afford coverage. The original intent of the ACA was to kind of smooth out some of those gaps in coverage. You know, it has effectively done that in more than half the country. But I think once the court turned this into an option, it kind of threw it into the midst of a very hotly debated political discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And you had state legislators and governors in many parts of the country who had been running against the Affordable Care Act as a political thing for so long, they just couldn't politically flip to a 180 and embrace a big piece of it. But I think we're still grappling in this country with questions around, are we lurching towards, in a piecemeal way, universal coverage? And what's the proper role of the federal government, especially for working-age adult populations? And I think in many places, that's still an issue that people are agreeing to disagree on.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, your Medicaid directors, they're living in very trying and unpredictable times, and they're also working for governors who are trying to balance their budget, trying to figure out what the rules of engagement are going to be. We've got the uncertainty of the CHIP reauthorization around the corner, and they've got a lot of tools at their disposal. They have these various waivers that they can use. And I'm wondering, what do you see out there that's exciting and creative about what people are doing?
You know, I represent all 56 of the states and territories.
Yep.
And, you know, my members, they work for a governor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in this country, about 2/3 of the nation's state governors are Republicans. So as we were trying to figure out how are we going to engage as a consensus bipartisan group, it was really, really challenging, actually. The first week after the election, I convened all the members and said, okay, you know, we weren't prepared to have a debate on the repeal of the ACA and block granting Medicaid. Where do we as a group find common ground? And I had one of my members say, hey, look, I just talked to my governor, and my marching orders are repeal the ACA and block grant Medicaid. And one of my other members said, my marching orders are to stand in front of the train.
Mm-hmm.
And so where we kind of ended up was, try to position our members as the trusted auto mechanic, if such a thing even exists anymore.
The click and clack of Medicaid. Exactly.
And to make sure that people understand this program before they go in and try to tinker around with it. And we largely stayed on the sidelines until about 2 months ago, when the Senate finally released language and details and specs of its health care reform bill. And when the smoke cleared, our Republican members looked at that and said, wow, we've spent the last 8 months trying to educate them.
Yeah.
They didn't listen to anything we said. This is horrible policy. This is damaging to states, and this is damaging to the people we serve. We have to come out and oppose it. But this fight isn't over. And while that is looming over all these other discussions, it's going to be very, very distracting. You know, you're looking at 25-30% cuts over a 10-year period to this program. And we run a very efficient, lean program, and there just isn't waste out there to cut. Real people get hurt in real ways.
Well, Matt, as you know, Mark and I lead a large community health center and also are very committed to innovation and research. And I'm often struck by the ways in which treating a significant population of Medicaid patients like ours provides a tremendous opportunity for developing new ways to really improve both individual health but also population health. But I know that the Medicaid directors are very committed to several important agendas really improving health and healthcare, including embedding behavioral health in primary care, really addressing better coordination of long-term care. But we'd love to hear you talk about the innovations that you've seen over the years, particularly utilizing Medicaid's large, complex population.
Yes, you know, by definition, Medicaid is serving the sickest, the frailest, the poorest, and the most medically complex people in the country. So if any system needs to improve, it's Medicaid, because we serve the people who need better health the most. About 5% of our population drives about 50% of all of our spending. So it really is trying to figure out those individuals with multiple complex conditions, with substance abuse and mental health issues. How has the U.S. healthcare system really failed these people historically, and how do we change it to bring the tools and resources and modern innovations to bear? When I look across the country, pretty much every Medicaid agency is transforming the U.S. healthcare system away from a grounding in fee-for-service and towards a future where the delivery system is more holistic, coordinated, and you've got to show me the money.
Yep.
The payment systems have to evolve as well. If all we're doing is arguing about the price of widgets, we need to reorient the healthcare system so that we are incentivizing physicians, hospitals, to get and to keep people healthy. You know, when you think about the fact that healthcare is now 18% of the nation's GDP, you've got a massive amount of resources vested in the status quo. And in the healthcare system today, when people are healthy, they don't go to the hospital. They don't end up in a nursing home. And when they don't, people don't get paid. So Medicaid that has to drive it. And I'm really excited about the things that we're doing. You know, states that have gone full-on managed care, like in Arizona or a Tennessee, we don't need to outsource this. We can do this in-house, right, like a Connecticut,
right,
where they've said, yeah, we're going to apply the coordination and management principles, but just do it in different ways.
We're speaking today with Matt Salo, Executive Director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors, which represents all 56 of the nation's state and territorial Medicaid directors. Matt, as you were speaking about that 18% of the GDP, couldn't help but think about the increasing and astronomical cost of prescription drugs, and there are new drugs coming out into the field. I mean, who amongst us would have thought 20 years ago that there'd be an actual cure for hepatitis C, but who would cost $100,000? And there are 70 million lives that the Medicaid directors happen. Why aren't we buying this en masse across the nation, trying to drive some of these, control these prices?
So I kind of think about things like hepatitis C, where it is fantastic that we have a cure. This is, you know, the CDC calls this the biggest public health crisis, and it's great that we've got a cure. Our folks freaked out, though, you know, when the first drug hit the market, and it was $1,000 a pill. And they realized that if we were to treat every person who's got Hep C, we would be spending as much on this one drug as we would on all other drugs for all other conditions combined. And if this is a real public health crisis, like, say, I don't know, polio or smallpox, it deserves a dedicated, unique, national/federal solution. And the price of some of these widgets is astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
But when we think about some of the price tags that come with it, there's a drug out there that treats spinal muscular atrophy. And kids who have this don't live to be adults. The treatment is $750,000 a year. We've got to figure out how do we make that more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Medicaid directors want to do in managed care, we're trying to do this in acute care, we're trying to do this everywhere, is how do we pay for outcomes rather than just paying for services, whether or not they work. There's a problem with the Medicaid law that doesn't really seem to allow us to do that for drugs. You know, I'll go back to hepatitis C. You know, the baby boomers who got it because of bad blood transfusion, then the younger adult who's got ongoing IV drug use, maybe has some mental health issues, and you've got a drug that potentially is, again, worth $1,000 a pill. And how are you going to make sure that you're actually, you know, getting the product to the patient and that the patient's being adherent to the medication? Is there a way that we could find some way to pay if the patient is cured and stays cured? We're not quite there yet, but we need to get there.
Well, Matt, speaking of drugs, but looking at a very different problem, the opioid crisis is certainly, I'm sure, on the minds of all of the Medicaid directors. I know the crisis was a main topic of discussion at the recent National Governors Conference. You know, there's some signals coming from Washington about what kind of support may be forthcoming to battle the opioid crisis, but I think in governor's offices across the country, in the Medicaid director's offices, they can't wait. And you've said that it looks like Medicaid is poised to become the nation's leading entity tasked with addressing this crisis. So talk with us about how you think this is going to play out.
Yeah, I think there's no question that a comprehensive, effective, affordable health insurance program, whether that be Medicaid or anything else, is part of the necessary answer for addressing the opioid crisis. And we've seen some of the data in Medicaid expansion states like Kentucky, like West Virginia, like Ohio, where the Medicaid expansion is accounting for 50, even 70% of all substance abuse treatment dollars in Medicaid. And that says to me that there is a huge, huge unmet need for comprehensive services in this population. And I think about governors like Governor Kasich in Ohio. As he has addressed and tried to address the opioid crisis, which is hitting Ohio very, very hard, the no-brainer for him was, in terms of the Medicaid expansion, he looked at it and says, "Is this is the way I can get to address the opioid crisis? All right, we're doing it. Let's do it." And, you know, he has personally made this a moral and ethical, even a religious test of, what are we doing in government? This is what we should be doing. But having said that, you know, just having Medicaid or just having insurance that covers this it's going to be necessary, but it's not sufficient. Because what we're really talking about is the reasons that people get to this place are multifaceted. So I think about at our big annual conference last year, we had this terrific author, Sam Quiñones, who wrote kind of the seminal book on the opioid crisis in America called Dreamland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as he finished up his speech, he looked out at the audience, you know, composed of Medicaid directors and health plans and, you know, physicians and drug companies and everybody in the Medicaid system. He looked out and he said, "We have a real crisis here, and you are all to blame for this." Mm-hmm. There is no answer, but there are many answers, and we are all going to have to work together to figure out how to rebuild community, and that will be the key to addressing the front end of this. So this is going to be a very, very big undertaking. Medicaid's got a huge part to play, but we're not going to be alone in it.
Well said. We've been speaking today with Matt Salo, Executive Director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors, which represents all 56 of the nation's states and territorial Medicaid directors. You can learn more about their work by going to MedicaidDirectors.org. Matt, thank you so much for the work that you do and for the Medicaid directors around the country and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the Trump administration hasn't said whether it will continue cost-sharing subsidies on the Affordable Care Act's insurance marketplaces in 2018. These payments, which go directly to insurance companies, are made to reduce out-of-pocket costs for those who earn between 100% and 250% of the federal poverty level and buy their own insurance on the state and federal marketplaces. Some insurers have said uncertainty over the future of those payments has caused them to request additional premium increases for 2018 beyond what they normally would have requested. And the Congressional Budget Office has come out with a new report on what would happen on the ACA marketplaces if the cost-sharing subsidies don't continue beyond the end of this year. Let's take a look at the CBO report. It said it expected insurers in some states would not participate in the marketplaces in 2018 because of uncertainty over a policy in which the cost-sharing subsidies end. But by 2020, more insurers would participate as they had time to see how markets operated under that policy. Insurers would still have to bear the cost of the subsidies by offering reduced deductibles and copays, even though they wouldn't get the payments from the federal government to cover those reductions. So, in response, insurers would raise premiums, specifically for the silver level plans. Those are the only plans for which cost-sharing subsidies are available. CBO projects that premiums for single individuals would increase by about 20% in 2018 compared with current law. And for 2020 and the following years, the premiums would be about 25% higher. Premiums for other plans would go up a few percentage points in the next 2 years, but later those plans wouldn't be priced differently than they would be under current law. Cutting off the subsidies would also increase the federal deficit by a net $194 billion over 10 years, CBO said. That's because the tax credits offered to help lower-income people pay for premiums would increase. Insurers have until September 5th to submit final rate requests for 2018. The Kaiser Family Foundation looked at preliminary numbers from 20 states in Washington, D.C., and found that, quote, the vast majority of insurers cite policy uncertainty in their rate filings. Some put specific numbers to that uncertainty, saying that they had included an additional premium increase ranging from 2% to 23% due to an assumption that the cost-sharing subsidies wouldn't continue. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and it's of particular interest to the Veterans Administration. An estimated 22 veterans per day are taking their own lives in what's being described as a post-war suicide crisis. With a lack of behavioral health clinicians available for every veteran who's experiencing difficulty, the VA has launched a campaign aimed at all Americans who know veterans who may be struggling to be aware that they can make a difference just by reaching out. It's called the Power of One campaign, the idea that one person reaching out to one veteran in a caring manner can make a difference.
The power of one small action, one conversation, or one phone call can make a difference in the life of a veteran going through a difficult time. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line or the Military.
According to Dr. Caitlin Thompson, Deputy Director of VA Suicide Prevention Program, it takes only a moment and just one small act can start them down the path to getting the support they need. The VA has launched a new suicide prevention hotline. It's now collaborating with community groups across the country to prepare them to better address the needs of these veterans, many of whom don't know how to ask for the help they need. Veterans, service members, and anyone concerned about them can call the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255. They can chat online at veteranscrisisline.net/chat or send a text to 838-255. All Veterans Crisis Line resources are optimized for mobile devices. A dedicated program aimed at reaching out to veterans across the country, empowering community groups and individuals to find ways of offering support to getting veterans the help they need before it's too late. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.